Welcome to Keeping Up With Data. I'm Emily.
I'm Pauline.
And today we have an exciting guest. I'm not going to introduce you. You can introduce yourself because it's best coming from you, Julian. Tell us who you are. Hello.
Thank you for inviting me. My name's Julian Seidenberg. I am head of AI at two AI software startups, which is Narrative and Datch. I can give some brief background on both.
Well, yeah, I reckon maybe we could dive into high level of those companies. And then, yeah. Do you know what? I would love to know a bit more about how you got to those companies as well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Definitely. So Narrative makes AI for professional photographers that enhances their creativity and speeds up their workflow. Mm-hmm. While Datch makes tools for frontline workers and their managers in industrial jobs. Think like an person doing electrical maintenance on machines in a factory, or someone maintaining the power grid, things like that.
Right, yeah. God.
Make better use of data to not reinvent the wheel every time that they need to fix something, and do better planning.
Brilliant. I mean, they're both really exciting subject matters and companies to be working for, particularly like at the same time, which is amazing. Well done to you.
it's so we'll definitely get into, a challenge.
Yeah, I can imagine. God, especially when they're like that early on in the stages of, I suppose, launch and growth and stuff like that.
Yeah, both quite different as well, I would say. So it's quite a nice balance you've got there, Julian. Very interesting.
Yeah, well, let's jump into like specifics on those two. But before we do it, I think it would be really good to get context around you and your journey and your background, because I know you've got a pretty interesting PhD behind you, which is existential kind of study?
It's not a PhD in existential angst. It's more like a PhD in ontology, which is the definition, how you define the world. So, yes.
Wow.
We can start there if you want.
Yeah, let's start.
Welcome to Keeping Up With Data. Keeping Up With Data is the podcast that keeps data enthusiasts up to speed with what is happening in the data world. We bring in the leading minds from the data industry to talk all things career, news, embarrassing stories, failures, and successes.
How did you choose that?
Oh, this is a long time ago. I'm older than I look. I started a PhD in 2004, and I was thinking to myself, I'd done relatively well in university, and I was thinking to myself, I want to do something. I want to do a PhD. I want to do something in something that's the future of technology, a future of computer science. And I was thinking, well, AI is the future, even then, of what we're doing. And at the time, there was this divide between what you would call neat and scruffy AI. Neat AI, which was at the time seen as the most likely to be successful, you define your concepts logically with rigorous first order logic, and then you program a computer to be able to do formal reasoning over that logical structure, so that you have this ability to reason over things and come to a definite conclusion. And then there was these upstarts doing neural networks, which was of course never going to work, where they were just messy, throw all the data in, let some computer optimize it. And back in 2004, that was hopeless. No one thought that would work. but of course we've seen otherwise. But the neat ontology based AI is making a comeback when combined with the large language model, and that's been part of Datch's success. So we can talk more about that. But yes, I did a PhD in what was at the time called the semantic web, but is more broadly than the ontologies.
Incredible.
Specification of conceptualizations.
I mean, like, I don't know if you've seen anyone with that kind of PhD, but it's pretty niche, which is great. Mm-hmm. And obviously quite, it lends a like nice hand to a lot of like what you've been probably doing.
Certainly not in 2004 as well. Like years ago to be already discussing these topics that are now, you know, the big thing in the tech world. You were more than 20 years ago, or nearly 20 years ago, I suppose. And yeah, super cool. Quite interesting. It must be a nice realization to see where it sort of started, I suppose, because you were there at its infancy and where it is now, I suppose. And quite a cool perspective, I suppose.
Yeah. And you're obviously not from New Zealand yourself. And being Kiwi, I would love to know what brought you to New Zealand as well.
Okay. So I'm born in Germany, but have American parents. So I grew up speaking English to my parents and German in school, and then went to the normal German education system, but then went to university in the UK. At the time I thought that the UK had a better university education system than Germany, and I preferred the style. So I went to university in the UK, studied there in Southampton for my undergraduate and Manchester for my PhD. And what brought me to New Zealand is a really interesting story, very non-traditional. While I was studying in the UK, I came across a meditation club. And I didn't believe, I thought meditation was mumbo jumbo, useless. So a friend of mine dragged me along though. And I said, well, okay, I'll come along, whatever. And I tried the meditation, I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is amazing. Can't believe how peaceful I feel even after 10 minutes of this meditation. I've never felt like this in my entire life. I need to keep doing this. So I kept doing that. It hugely helped in my university studies and improved my quality of life, my mental health, all those things. And then I met the meditation group, ended up being a Hare Krishna meditation group. And I met one of the senior monks who was one of the leaders of the Hare Krishna organization. On the day of my last exam in London. And through a series of conversations, he ended up inviting me to come to New Zealand. And I spent a year being a monk in an ashram in New Zealand.
What?
Studying the ancient Vedic writings, Sanskrit writings of ancient India. Wow. And meditating 2 hours a day.
What?
And that's how I first came to New Zealand.
My gosh, you must be like, so you must have such a strong mind after all of that, and obviously like mind, body, soul, but that is crazy. So do you still practice meditation like two hours a day?
Every day.
Amazing.
Practice some meditation.
My goodness. I'm curious, and I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but like how has it changed your, because everyone talks about neurological pathways, they're easily they're malleable, right? So you can like reform, reshape them. Do you think it had much of a change to your brain doing that for that length of period of time?
I obviously can't compare what I would have been if I hadn't gone down that path, but definitely I can see my mind is certainly more peaceful with situations and I can intensely focus on things.
Right. Gosh, that's amazing. Did you go like... one more question on that. Sorry. When you were practicing as a monk, did you practice like in silence, like the whole year, or was it like you were actually around, walking around, doing normal jobs and all that kind of stuff?
Common misconception is that meditation has to be this silent Buddhist meditation.
Yes,
Hare Krishna meditation is not silent meditation. It's uses mantra meditation, which is repeating a certain spiritually imbued words.
Yeah.
And that has benefits because silent meditation is really hard because the mind will just wander and think of so many things. Yeah. Whereas if you have a mantra, and you also use beads for, so you focus your sense of touch, you focus your hearing, you focus your speech. So all of these senses are engaged rather than empty. So it's a lot easier to focus than it would be with pure silent meditation. So I was doing mantra meditation the whole time.
I see.
That makes sense, actually. Now I think about it, you do end up running away with your thoughts if you're not like focused on something.
I was going to say, that's what I pictured when you initially said that. So I was like, I don't know how people do it in respect to those who can, but I don't think I could sit in complete silence for 2 hours and try and think about nothing. It's that sounds a bit more up my alley, I would say, if anything else.
Gosh. Oh, well, I respect that. That is amazing. You must carry that through into your career as well, obviously, that kind of like mental stability and discipline as well.
One funny story. When I was, I did the mantra meditation monk thing in between my undergraduate degree and my PhD. Mm-hmm. So when I was interviewing for my PhD, coming right out of being a monk for a year, I interviewed with one of the professors, and she said, "Oh, your grades are fantastic. You did so well in the interview, but you're too peaceful.
What?
Will you be able to swim with the sharks in the PhD?" And in a sense, she was right, because the PhD was challenging, definitely, and challenging from an intellectual point of view, but also challenging from a the culture of academia can be very harsh sometimes. Yeah. So being able to survive in that world.
I reckon you could tell me if I'm wrong, but there would be a lot of comparison. Do you know what I mean? Like that would really take over, because you're obviously in a cohort of people doing maybe a similar PhD or at least the same sort of timeline. So that would be really hard to overcome, in my opinion.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I survived it, and I think came out stronger for it, and it was definitely useful.
But amazing.
Yeah.
And then obviously
I don't think anyone will say that a PhD was a nice experience for them.
No, but you probably are like, look back, I'm glad I did it in some way. Gotcha. Well, then obviously you've moved into more like solution architecture, development, and obviously like really specifically AI-based NLP, all those kinds of things in a lot of different companies, including like the big ones like Spark in New Zealand. And now you're at what I think we should talk to, Narrative and Datch. So obviously you touched on what they were focusing high level, but how do you want to approach explaining both? And maybe actually explain your role across both to start.
Okay, let's start with one. let's pick Narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. My role is head of AI at Narrative. I lead the AI team at Narrative. Narrative is a really interesting company. Startup, VC-founded startup, founders fund, a big American venture capitalist, is one of the main investors. Narrative came out of the realization that there was no software that really took an AI-first approach for professional photographers to speed up their workflow. So much software in AI and otherwise hacks on AI as an afterthought, where, we have this thing, let's add the chatbot in. And it seems like every software that you use these days, it's like, oh, look, we have our AI chatbot. Come use it. And it's more annoying than useful in most cases. Where Narrative took this approach, how can we use AI? Think of how we integrate AI from first principles to really benefit the user. So when I joined Narrative, we had just released the beta version of Narrative Select, which is a photo selection tool that uses AI to help the user select the best photos in a photo shoot. A wedding photographer will shoot 5 to even 10,000 images in a wedding. And it will usually, without our tool, it will take them a week just to look through all those photos and select the ones that they want to give to the client, give to the wedding couple. So with Narrative Select, we do things like group all of the photos in the shoot into scenes. So you can see similar photos, of which you only want to use maybe one in that scene. And then it will analyze all the faces, analyze who's important in the photo, who's not important, who can we ignore, who has a nice expression on their face, who has their eyes open, who has their eyes closed. Maybe in one circumstance, eyes closed is actually good. In another circumstance, eyes closed is open. We interpret the context to understand, which is really hard, by the way, build a model to understand context of a photo and to understand what people are doing, how they're interacting, and suggest these are perhaps the top three photos in the scene, and always leave it up to the photographer to choose, to use their human judgment to go, well, actually, this one tells the story the best. This one complements what was going on. And we run all this AI on the user's device, which gives great benefits to privacy, where so much of AI is, especially the image generation AI, is that, wow, they're stealing artists' work and all that. No, we're not doing that. It's run entirely on your device. You don't have to send us any of your photos. And it runs a lot faster. You don't have need an internet connection, all those kind of benefits. So running accurate AI on device is like extra challenging. And it's been an interesting journey there. We had to label all our own images because there was no AI models out there that met the particular constraints that we had.
Wow. It sounds like you guys are, well, I have not heard of anyone that's in competition with you per se, because I feel like you're quite leading in the market. Am I right in assuming that? Or
we have a few competitors for sure who've mostly come after us and started imitating what we do.
Yes.
But I think we're definitely the market leader in terms of the quality of the software.
Yeah, got you.
I was just going to add, like you sort of covered it on those points there, Julian, but the issue around privacy, you know, has affected some of those competitors that you mentioned, you know, in the past. But how does being on device sort of secure that? Is it just because it's not connected to the cloud or to other sort of online sort of access points? And is that the biggest differentiator that you would say about the narrative product compared to some of the other tools out there, or something else you can perhaps highlight?
Yeah, there's many differentiators. I would say that Facebook is kind of people describe it as a Skinner box to make you condition you into thinking that your privacy doesn't matter. And it's been very successful in that regard. So we find most people really don't mind the privacy. Maybe like 1 in 10 people are really concerned about privacy. The other 9 are like, yeah, take my images. I don't really mind too much. Apple, of course, is playing big on the privacy, and they also run machine learning models on the phone in their case. And they lean heavily into that. So privacy is a benefit, definitely, but it's not the core differentiator for us. I would say the benefits of running on device in addition to privacy are that you can run a lot faster because you're running a small model that runs relatively quickly. And you don't have to upload anything to the internet. You're not reliant on a spotty internet connection. And it's cheaper for everyone involved because you already have the computer. The computer can run the model. You don't need to have a giant cloud server farm that that uses lots of power, contributes to global warming, all those things. Running it on the user's device gives lots of benefits in that regard. Though, of course, it's a challenge because we cannot run a very large, sophisticated model. So tuning a model that's small enough to run on device while also being accurate enough to satisfy the user, that's definitely a challenge. We spent much time trying to get that working.
Yeah, I remember when we met first as well, you mentioned like how you structure your team and like you focus a lot on collaboration. And obviously when what you just said there around like, it's taken a while to get there. Like, it sounds like you've got the right people in your team that are working and complementing each other to be able to get there. Is there any sort of strategy that you've gone with or thought about to make sure you get the right people to enhance the product and build it?
Narrative has a really amazing culture where we value team collaboration. We work at our best when we build products that are not just AI, but where the entire skill set of the company comes together. We have our product people, our marketing people, the Rust engineering people who build the app, the front end people who make the user interface, the AI team, and our data labeling team, all those people coming together, all contributing their skills and collaborative building something that no single person could have built by themselves.
Yeah. And I think that is, I suppose, like the secret sauce to a degree. Like, everyone who is trying to be quite like individual and siloed maybe isn't utilizing the right skill sets and like strengths to be able to like win together. So that's amazing. You'd be surprised how like, what's the word, rare it is. How do you deal with like the misconception, I would say, that AI is like almost like, it's like demonized in the market around like, it's going to take people's jobs, it's evil, it's all this like, obviously that kind of sentiment. How do you navigate those conversations in relation to even narrative and then moving into Dash as well?
Yes, definitely. There's this conception that evil AI is coming for your jobs and make you obsolete. Mm. Let's go. There's this big movement actually to sabotage the AI. You can embed something in images which distorts the machine learning model if it tries to learn from images. So many people are doing that to all your images as a way of sabotaging the AI. This evil AI, let's sabotage it. Let's drag it down before it takes our jobs. The way I think of this is that the easy, simple thing to do is to think of AI as purely efficiency gain. And efficiency gain means that we need less people to do the same work. So we can do the same work with less people, which means we can fire half our staff or whatever it is. And have AI augment the people to do more job. The way I personally think of this and the way both Narrative and Datch think of this is no, efficiency gain might be there, but we give you the efficiency gain to enable you to do more and grow your business. In the case of Narrative, for example, the type of thing that our AI does, the human doesn't want to do anyway. Looking through, imagine a group shot with 50 people in say a wedding full group shot, and pre-Narrative you had to, and you've taken 50 images, you have to zoom into all of the 50 faces, check are the eyes open, are they smiling, and then go to the next image, do the same, and then remember which image was best. It would take an hour just to select, where our AI can just tell you this one's probably the best. And probably it is. So you get massive efficiency gain and allows the photographer to focus on taking better photos, on not be afraid of taking lots of photos because the AI can help them, and doing better work, doing very detailed editing of the photos to get the best results out.
Yeah.
Where similarly in Datch, when we're working with, say, a work planner who some problem has come up, they are writing some instructions for one of their workers to take a look at this press. Say, we have a press, it's broken for some reason, it's malfunctioning, take a look and investigate. The work planner will assign a person, roughly estimate how long it will take, but really has no digital support to help them with that. Whereas with Datch, they can ask Datch, has this thing happened before? And Datch can come back, search through 10-year history of everything that happened, and come back with a concise summary of, well, this happened before. This time, this was the cause. This was done to resolve that.
Wow.
And it'll probably cost as much to repair. And this is how long it would take. Makes the planner's job so much easier, better task allocation, better for the worker also, because they know exactly what to do. They don't have to guess. They don't have to spend their time reinventing the wheel, diagnosing what might have caused a problem. So it can increase industrial efficiency. And in the cutthroat market of manufacturing, it's any competitive advantage that a company can get is not, you won't fire people, you actually hire more people because you get more contracts, you're a better manufacturer, have better margins, so you can reinvest that money.
Yeah, my God. I on the Narrative thing, I just thought about, like, the other day I was, before I jumped into Datch, I was like scrolling through my photos, because you know how you take, like, a lot of people these days take like 20 photos of the same situation just to make sure that they got the right ones, so everyone's happy that they look good. But actually, when I was scrolling through them, I'm like, oh, and I just give up, because I'm like, I just don't want to delete all of them in case I get the wrong one or whatever. So that totally makes sense. It's just definite, like, efficiency.
Yeah. And just before we sort of jump onto that Datch section as well, I think you guys also have a product called Narrative Edit. You spoke quite highly about Narrative Select, and you sort of touched on it there, Narrative Edit. What's the differentiator there, I suppose, or what's unique about that product?
Yeah, Narrative Edit is our latest product. We released it a couple of months ago, where once you have the selection and you know, okay, these are the photos I want to go forward with.
Yeah.
The next step in Narrative Select is to send those photos to Lightroom or your favorite photo editing software and do the color correction and detailed editing, which is also extremely time consuming for the photographer, if not more so. because there's 100 sliders in Lightroom, and you can adjust all of them, and you go, well, a little bit like this, a little bit like this. Okay, that's perfect. And you, doing that on 100 photos, if you take maybe 10 minutes to do a detailed edit on each photo, the time really adds up. What we do with narrative edit is that most professional photographers have a large collection of photos they've already edited. They have a specific style that's their personal way of editing, and their signature style, their signature look of how they edit their photos. Mm-hmm. And that's their competitive advantage, where they go, I have my look. You hire me as a professional photographer to get that unique look that you can't get from anyone else. Yeah. So we take the photographer's previous edits, learn from them, build a custom machine learning model, custom to only them, and then download that machine learning model to their device so that they can run that machine learning model and pre-edit the images in their particular style. Mm-hmm. So it's not just like a preset that you apply or say an Instagram filter that you press one button and it's always the same. Yeah. Here, it's depending on the circumstance of the image, it will set the right white balance, set the right exposure. Some photographers prefer kind of a dark, moody style. Others have a bright, oversaturated style and will adjust every image individually to match the photographer's style of editing. Mm. And sometimes the model, of course, every machine learning model has a certain accuracy. We'll get it wrong, but we're much closer than the photographer would be to starting from scratch. So we find some people claim they save 90% of their editing time by us pre-editing the photo for them, which allows, again, the photographer to enhance their work. Either they can get that time back, or what we find most photographers who really care about the quality of their photography will use that gain time to do very detailed editing, where they might, here's an ugly scratch on the wall, let me clone that out. Or I'll do some, here's a face, let me do some detailed editing on that face to make it look perfect and really enhance the quality of their work, leveling themselves up to another level of photography. And of course, benefiting the client also by giving them the most beautiful, best photos that they could imagine.
I also just thought when you were speaking there and also tying it into the Datch story you were going into, like one of the key things that you and both companies do is save time.
Yeah.
Obviously, like that competitive advantage from a Datch point of view is like you get to solve the query problem, whatever it might look like, quicker than maybe some that don't have that kind of tool. And same goes for like narrative, obviously, because you take so long to crawl through photos and actually find the right thing, especially if like it's creative as well. Mm-hmm. You kind of get in your head about it. So I suppose like it's an enabler to be more creative from a narrative perspective. And then also for Datch, it's like you're across the problem quicker, you're saving time, you're probably saving money in the long run as well, which is pretty unique.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. I was going to ask more about like, I suppose, any problems, because not problems, challenges, better word, from inception. Or conception, I should say, not inception, of both of these businesses. Like, what are the major challenges that you've faced? Because it's not easy getting a business like this off the ground, and you've been quite pivotal parts to both of them.
Well, what are some major challenges that I've faced?
Or maybe like two key ones.
Yeah. There's the technical challenge, of course. There's definitely a challenge finding the right people to. As we've been working with precision sourcing, of course, also to try to find the right people for our business. But I think one of the biggest challenges for narrative is the thing that you don't think of. There's most people, when they think of machine learning models, they think of, well, you need to build a machine learning model, right? No, the biggest challenge is not building the machine learning model. That's hard. That's technically hard. But getting the right data is much harder than building the model. And often that is you need non-traditional approaches to get that data. What we did at Narrative is that we paid professional photographers to give us their images, to license us their images to train with. And then we employed a labeling company to label hundreds of thousands of images for us. And labeling is hard. There's lots of nuance in exactly what you want to label in which circumstance. And the data orchestration pipeline flow of where all these labeled images live and how they move around and how you can ultimately train models with them. That's also difficult. Mm. And just deciding what you want to label in the first place. What are you even trying to achieve? None of this stuff existed before we started. So we need to invent entirely new ways of using machine learning models in ways they hadn't been used before. And combining multiple machine learning models together to achieve a certain outcome. So the creative product development, collaborative product development for both companies, actually, is probably the most challenging thing. Where at Datch, for example, RAG, retrieval augmented generation, is all the rage. Everyone's talking about, RAG this, RAG that, where you can take enterprise knowledge, enterprise documents, and search over them with a chatbot. You can ask, you can connect your ChatGPT to an enterprise knowledge source, say your SharePoint library of every document you have in your company. And ask questions with a chatbot interface on that data set. And that's the obvious thing to do. And that's something that we also support at Datch, but it's not the full thing. It's not the only thing. And that alone is not enough. So thinking a bit beyond what the mass people are doing and being innovative and forward looking.
Good articulation of that, actually, because it sounds like there'll be a lot of challenges, but that in particular makes total sense, particularly at that stage of your journey in the business.
I suppose, Julian, on that topic around RAG, could you maybe give us just a general, for the public listening to our podcast, what retrieval augmented generation is in a more general sense, a short summary perhaps?
I take these things somewhat for granted. I appreciate that not everyone is as deep in AI as I am, of course. Okay, retrieval augmented generation is a technique to use a large language model such as ChatGPT or any other large language model to answer questions based on a large collection of data. Large language models have a limited context window. And that's how many words can you input into your large language model at once to make sense of it. Some advanced large language models have context windows of hundreds of thousands of words, but they are also very expensive to run. And even hundreds of thousands of words are not enough to encompass an enterprise knowledge repository, document repository. So what RAG does is that, first of all, we use an embedding model, which creates a number that represents the meaning of a collection of words. So you take every page or every paragraph of the documents, of all the documents you have, convert that segmentation of the document into a vector, which is just a series of numbers. And each number represents some kind of meaning. So you might have color as a meaning. So each number represents a different nuance of color, or you might have royalty as a meaning, as a vector of meaning. So -10 might be peasant, +10 might be king, and 0 might be normal. And so each number, people don't understand exactly what each number represents, but each number represents some kind of nuance of meaning. So when a user asks a question to the chatbot, say, what's the annual leave procedure in this company? We convert that question into a vector, into a representation of the meaning, annual leave. And then we search our collection of all the vectors of all the documents that we have in our knowledge base for a match to that same vector that the question represents. And we find maybe 10, 20 pages of documents in the enterprise knowledge that seem like a close match. And then we take those 20 pages, give them to the large language model as context, and ask the large language model to answer the user's question based on that specific context taken from the the larger document set. And that greatly limits the context window that the large language model needs to have. And it, you want to over-select, you want to select some things that are irrelevant, but the large language model is smart enough to exclude the irrelevant stuff and understand perhaps potential duplicates in the information or reconcile conflicting information and give you a useful answer based entirely on the source knowledge, rather than doing what is common in a large language models, which is just making something up, making up a hallucination that might be completely wrong and not aligned with the company policy.
I see. Now, does that also tie into the importance of feedback loops? Like, are those two sort of integral in both of them working together, or is that completely different? I'm sort of just trying to wrap my head around it. Yeah,
many companies think, okay, we do the RAG prototype, we deploy it, users start using it, and inevitably it gets stuff wrong. For whatever reason, you've written your prompt slightly incorrectly, the search is not working the way it needs to, or something else goes wrong in between. Mm-hmm. And people are very quick to write off AI, think, this LLM, it was all overhyped anyway. So instead, what is really important is to have some kind of feedback loop where the user can label something, okay, this was wrong, and you go in and fix it. And so over time, you develop a validation set that you can test your LLM. You might, new version of ChatGPT comes out, you might want to integrate that. Does it still work? Does it still answer all your user's questions? You want to be able to test that on all your collected feedback, as well as give confidence, of course, that it's giving the correct answer, and do your best to always be improving the quality of the large language model response. So, of course, we do that at Datch. We have an internal labeling tool that we built that allows us to look at the user's feedback, rate it, categorize it, and then automate the testing of different prompts, different ability to improve the responses. So when we work with large Fortune 500 clients, we deploy a prototype, of course, and from the feedback in the prototype, we're rapidly iterating, much faster than most IT teams. Within days, we're getting from something that seems like it's kind of dumb to something that's really helpful for the company.
I see. Okay. And I suppose tying into the future trends that you're seeing, you know, where narrative is headed, Datch as well, but perhaps more generally towards the industries and other sectors, right? You touched on some big 500 clients that you help this product with. Where do you see the future trends of Gen AI and things like, you know, RAG and feedback loops heading into the future?
Yeah, I would say we're right at the peak of the hype cycle of large language models. And there is a big disillusionment that they are not magic. They cannot do everything with no work. And of course, in any hype, the IT industry goes through many hype cycles. And when the hype cycle collapses down into the trough of disillusionment, people are disillusioned. Many companies that were overvalued run out of money, of course. But through the end of that, the companies that do have something valuable survive and come through and deliver some compelling business value using the technology. So we're definitely going to go through that. And it'll be a little bit ugly, but I feel confident that both Narrative and Datch have a great product that is not just on the bandwagon, but delivers some real value.
Yeah, they sound like, well, the industries that you're in and whatnot is like really practical, like kind of helps everyone's day-to-day rather than just inventing a really cool tool to be like, we do AI. So I think that's one of your big differentiators is the industries that you sit in as well, based on the product.
And certainly in the manufacturing or utility industries that we're working with, the tool we're providing is mind-blowing for many of the clients we're working with, where maybe their IT system was built in the 1970s and we were coming through and delivering this advanced RAG voice assistant technology. It's definitely a game changer for many of these companies.
Definitely, it sounds like it. Well, I feel like we're getting to the end of the podcast, but maybe before we get further into the end, I suppose it'd be good to understand for the audience, more particularly, and sort of a shameless plug for you as a leader and also for both of the business stats and narrative, like what would someone maybe expect from an environment point of view if they come to work for you in either of those, or even just generally for you as a leader? And then I suppose a two-prong question is like, what maybe what you stand for in your leadership style as well. Mm.
What someone would expect is, of course, as we touched on, very collaborative company where certainly people are given the autonomy to do the work whatever way works best for them, as long as we get to the result. But no person is an island here where we need to work together and communicating. Technical skills are not enough. It takes the communication skills, the social skills, the respect for each other to be able to really make progress. I don't have all the answers. I very much appreciated when even the most junior team member says, no, you're wrong, and calls me out when I make a mistake, which happens all the time. So very much appreciate this idea of the right ideas, the best ideas win, rather than the person with the loudest voice or the biggest title. And personally, what was the second part of the question?
Just like you and your leadership style. You sort of touched on it there, I suppose. Like you create the floor to be open so that it's not a hierarchical thing. It's more of a I suppose the best person with the best idea comes through no matter how loud they are. But anything else that I suppose you live by and you've been able to cultivate really like rich and talented teams based on what you've sort of lived by as a leader?
What I really add to the company is figuring out what the right thing to do is at the right circumstance. And that, again, is a discussion. I'm sometimes wrong with that, of course. But looking at the big picture, being a little bit detached from the day-to-day work and thinking about, well, this is what we're doing. And then giving everyone that big picture in the language that they can understand. Someone in product has a different language and needs to be communicated with in a different way. Someone in the AI team that needs detailed information of the big picture. And then they can, with that big picture in mind, a person can really understand what they need to do and why and make independent progress. And I found that many people I've worked with have learned that big picture thinking, that communication, and when they've gone on to other companies, really benefited from the time. And I find working at startups is so much fun, and we learn so much faster than in bigger companies, because there's this nothing between you and the work to be done. They're removing all the barriers, allowing work to flow smoothly, and people can do their best work and their best learning.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose that sort of ties in nicely into my sort of final questions I always like to ask our guests. But any tips or insights for young professionals who want to follow a similar sort of career trajectory to yours, young data scientist, AI engineer, it's all new to the market and you've been successful in your role. So maybe three things that you can recommend to our audience perhaps?
Yeah, sure. First thing, of course, maximize learning definitely in early career. There might be multiple jobs, some might pay better. I would definitely always go for the job that where the learning opportunity is the biggest, because if someone can maximize investing in themselves, in their own skills, in their own knowledge, that's far more valuable than any kind of money, certainly in the long term. And in the and just in terms of satisfaction and fun of someone working in their working life. Then also, the technical skills are only so much. Once someone gets to the intermediate level, really their technical skills are good enough, unless they're in some super specific niche technical field. The soft skills, it's maybe a bit cliche, but the soft skills and the ability to communicate, to write well, and to communicate things in the right level of sophistication to the person they're communicating to is so essential. And I see that severely lacking in many candidates, where technical candidates will speak to everyone in technical language that completely goes over the tops of people's heads.
Yeah.
And learning that skill is is extremely hard, and but also so valuable for people.
Yeah.
And then a final piece of advice for someone learning, I would say, is to many people struggle to get their first job out of university. And lots of internships, I find, are the best way. Volunteering to work, even if I would never hire anyone. If someone offers to work for free, I would still pay them, because the amount that an intern would cost is not much in the overall corporate budget. But really putting themselves out there, building their network and connecting and working in many different environments in the early, even throughout university, getting that work experience. The abstract nature of working in university is very different from working in an actual job. And so many jobs say, well, you need this much commercial experience. And then they're the reason why commercial experience is so valuable and so important when hiring someone. It's not just this conspiracy to stop you hiring university students.
Yeah.
It really is important. And most people in their first year of out of university don't really add any value to a company because they haven't learned the what it takes. So.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
So
they're just acting as a sponge.
And working and getting the experience, I would say.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Julian. It's been a real pleasure getting to know yourself, the businesses Dutch and Narrative, of course, and just hearing your perspective on the AI landscape and where it is now, where it's been and where it's headed. I think that's all from us today.
Yeah.
And we really appreciate your time.
And if you are listening in the audience and you want to connect with Julian, obviously you've got a LinkedIn profile, so do connect in with him, connect in with us, and follow the journey of Narrative and Dutch, because it's definitely one to be watched. But thank you, Julian.
Thanks for having me on. It was my pleasure.
So something really important for us here at Precision Sourcing is mental health. It's something we've been focused on a lot over the last year or so. And we're lucky enough to have partnered with the Black Dog Institute. And we're going to be doing a lot of events with them this year. A lot of our events, money will be going towards them. And they're out there aiming to create a mentally healthier world for everyone. So if you wish to support the cause, please donate via the link in the bio on this podcast. And you'll be seeing a lot more information about Black Dog over the next year.